Welcome to Your True North, a program that explores how values act as a compass, directing our lives and work. Inspiring guests tell how key events and influential figures shaped their values and how they've used those values to create a life rich in meaning, accomplishments, and personal satisfaction. Your True North is hosted by Cindy Camp. Are you seeking your true north? Then welcome.
Welcome to Your True North. I'm your host, Cindy Camp. Today I will be talking with Gerald Murnane, an author from Australia, who's written over a dozen books, including The Plains, and most recently, Border Districts. He worked as a teacher during the early part of his career, and he's a great fan of horse racing. It's an honor to have you as a guest with me today, and I want to welcome you, Gerald. I wanted to ask you a little bit more, I think, about your experiences as a young person before we talk more about your adult life. I know you studied briefly to be a Catholic priest, and I'm wondering what role religion played in your childhood.
Well, it was the most important important element in my childhood, because we went to church every mass every Sunday. We went regularly to the sacraments. It was drilled. My parents didn't say much about it, but my Catholic teachers made it clear that it was the most important part of my life. But recently, and I lost, to use that old-fashioned expression, I lost my faith quietly and calmly in my 20th year while reading a novel by Thomas Hardy, and that would take a lot of explaining.
Which one of his novels, if I can ask? Which novel?
I think it was Tess of the D'Urbervilles. There's a story in itself. I've quickly touched on this. One of the religious brothers that taught me in my 17th or 16th year dismissed Hardy. We didn't have any of his books in class, but we could have had. They were set as a possible textbook for English literature. And the brother said, "We're not going to study Hardy. We'll do Dickens instead." Hardy was a pessimist and an atheist who doesn't bear our it's not worth our interest. And that, of course, made me interested in him. But I was only 17, and 3 or 4 years later, I found his books in the library and read about half a dozen of them. And, as I said, quietly lost my faith, but never been critical or vindictive or harsh about any of the experiences I had as a Catholic child. But something that I was going to say, and I'll just have to pause while it comes back to me. You asked me about... Oh, I know what it was. Yeah, right. Yeah. I have, next year in Australia, I always wanted to be a poet rather than a novelist. Mm. And I finally... The poetry I wrote when I was young wasn't fashionable and hardly any got published. But I've written a volume of poetry that will be published next year. And in it, I wrote a poem about my childhood religious beliefs, and I can't quote the poem now, but the point that I made was that it almost distressed me as a child that my religion, which was supposed to be the most important part of my spiritual life or my mental life, my religion never reached, and these are the words that I used in the poem, my religion never reached the part of me that fiction and horse racing reached. So that if this allegedly important set of beliefs, it was there, I would have been devoted to it. That's not quite the word. I stood by those beliefs. I tried to experience them in all their coolness and richness, but if I'd honestly asked the question, what is most important to you in your emotional life or your spiritual life, your inner life, I would have had to say honestly, horse racing and reading about personages. So that, and eventually the personages and the horse racing and the other elements in my imaginative life won out, and religion, I think a good word would be to say it withered. I didn't sort of discard it or run away from it, but my religious beliefs withered. But they left me, and I think there's a question on in your mind about the legacy of my religious beliefs. It left me with a great deal of valuable items, a devotion to introspection. What did we used to do as Catholic children? We examined our consciences to see what sins we'd committed. Well, I've been a great examiner of my own conscience and my own inner workings. The other thing is a contempt. My religious childhood left me with a contempt for materialism. I just cannot and never have been satisfied with materialism as a worldview. I'm an eccentric person, and I've invited a lot of I've been laughed at times by telling people my honest belief, but I don't even believe the theory of evolution to have any basis. In fact, I think of it more as a fairy story, with just a few little things to support it. But we won't go in that direction. But I have a deep and lasting belief in the survival of the soul. It never changed, whether I belong to the Catholic Church or I don't belong to it, or my beliefs deep down are pretty well about the soul and survival and things like conscience. That they are pretty well what they always were.
And it sounds like, as you're saying, even though your religion withered around the age of 20, that these habits and these insights have stayed with you throughout your lifetime. Certainly the importance, the ability to be introspective has been so valuable for you as a writer and someone who investigates the imagination. And I admire your lack of interest in materialism. I think that's somewhat unusual in our 21st century world. So that certainly sounds like a very positive legacy.
Well, I've never mixed much with other writers. And when I have, I've always been amazed to think that to find that they seem to assume that because a person is a writer or into some field of creative endeavor, that that person shares a common fund of, well they're not really beliefs, they're almost non-beliefs. That writers, we've all got to be political, left-wing politically. We believe in, we are materialists, we don't have any allegiance to church or any belief in an afterlife. And I don't belong among, that doesn't describe me at all. And so I've been a bit of a loner and kept away from, I keep my thoughts and I don't say much about these things, but no one's ever going to persuade me. I mean, my beliefs are firm. I mention here someone who's hardly, I wonder whether many readers will ever heard of the man. He was a 19th century English writer. He wrote a couple of novels, but he's best. The field he was best suited to was he wrote about nature. He grew up in the country near Swindon in Wiltshire. His name was Richard Jefferies, Jefferies. He wrote a book with a rather off-putting title called The Story of My Heart. It was a book that's almost impossible to understand. He was an atheist. Well, I won't say he was an atheist. He had no interest in investigating the question of whether there was a God or a personal, certainly not a personal God, but he believed in a thing called soul life, and he tried to write about it. His belief arose from his deep attachment to the natural things, the way the wind blew the grass and the feathers ruffled on a bird, or the water rippled in a stream. He had this passionate interest in natural things, and it led him to this belief in soul life. And I'm not a disciple of Jefferies, but when I first read his books, especially The Story of My Heart, it chimed in with a lot of my own beliefs, that feeling that we waste our time trying to get close to God. It's up to God to... God has revealed to us as much as it's good for us to know. And I know this sounds a preposterous and rather arrogant thing to say, but I'll say it. I have the feeling that if God is there, he or she or it, I'll say God wants us to get on with our own business, which is not the business of getting close to him at the moment. That might come in a future stage of our existence. So our business is to get to know this world and get to know each other and get to know our own minds and what we're made of. And I'll even mention something else that I heard completely by chance. I can't use computers. I'm using a smartphone at the moment. Somebody taught me how to do that. But I was watching my son watching a religious program on his computer, and a Sufi. I knew nothing about the Sufis. I've never been interested in them. But this Sufi gentleman, was just explaining his belief that we are actually, that how we come into existence is that there's a big queue in heaven, a big queue of angels putting up their hands, me next, please God, me next. And what the angels are asking for is a chance to be given bodies and to be born into a material existence, that they have the chance of living the life in the place where we are right now. Preposterous it might sound to some, but it chimed in with my own belief that this is a strange existence, that our bodies really, we're more than our bodies. Our bodies are just something that we've been given to learn about, I won't go any further because I'll get too deeply into it, but have I made a little bit of sense?
Absolutely. And I am so grateful for knowing about Jeffrey's work. I haven't read anything that he's written, but it sounds like it's had a great impact on you and his ideas about the soul and your own ideas about what in us is lasting or goes beyond our material existence is a fascinating topic. And I appreciate you bringing that up. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about, I guess, your writing. I know, you've spent most of your career as a writer, and your books are internationally known. Their roots go deep into the Australian soil. For many listeners, especially those here in the United States, it'll be intriguing to learn that you've never been outside of Australia and rarely outside of your state of Victoria. I'm curious if you could imagine living anywhere else or at any other point in time. And I'll just add that I well suspect that you have those sorts of thoughts. I know, again, you have a rich imagination. But I'm just curious what your answer to that question would be.
Oh, I get it. That's one of the most common questions that I get asked. People, a group of students, once I gave them a whole lot, I said, here are 10 things you can ask me about. And they nearly all wanted to ask me, why don't you travel? Why haven't you traveled? Well, there's 10 ways or 20 ways I could answer. I've never tried this one before. One thing I will say that people have actually even accused me people have accused me of being affected, that this is some kind of eccentricity that I've willingly taken on. It is not at all. I've been to Sydney, which is a much bigger city than I was born in Melbourne. I know Melbourne pretty well. I don't care if I ever go back there again. It's a big, horrible place to me now, but I live in a tiny township in the far west of Victoria. But my two of my sons are in Melbourne, and I have to go there occasionally. But I've been to Sydney a couple of times, and the last time I went to Sydney was in 2007 when I was in my late 60s. And I had to go there. Well, I decided I would go there to receive an award. And I had a free day. I was put up at a little boutique hotel in the centre of the city. And I was only there for 2 days. One day I was busy with engagements and lunches with friends and things. But the last day after the award, for some reason I couldn't get a train connection or something. Anyway, I got this free day. I spent it in my hotel room reading a book. Now, Sydney is a vast city with art galleries and all kinds of attractions, as people would call it. And I could have done anything I wanted to. I could have, I wasn't short of money. I'd just been given a large sum of money as an award for my life's achievements as a writer. I could have done anything, but I sat in my hotel room reading a book. I didn't want to know about Sydney. I just wanted to get back where I felt at home And it's more than just feeling at home. There's something strange about me in that I like to know the compass points. I like to know where north, south, east and west are. I like to know where I stand in relation to my birthplace in Melbourne, to my ancestral town or city called Warrnambool on the coast of the west of Victoria, Bendigo, where I spent my happy childhood and learned about horse racing. I just like to feel that I'm in the places, surrounded by the places that matter to me, that I know where the sun is going to rise in the morning. There's one last comment or one last way of answering the question. I'm too busy. All my life, the attractions, the puzzles to be solved, the matters to be investigated, the books to be read, the imaginary horse races to be documented and written about. I never take holidays. I just work. I do my favourite thing 7 days a week. Even though I have to bring up a family, and I'm pretty sure I did it very well. And I had to sacrifice my time for my family often. But left to myself, I have so much that I want to do here at my desk or out in the backyard or even on the golf course nowadays. I couldn't be bothered travelling. It doesn't interest me. I can read books about places. I love Hungary. I've learnt the Hungarian language that's another story which I'll never get time to tell on this program, but people say, now you've learnt the language, when are you going to Hungary? I'm not going to Hungary. Why would I want to go to Hungary? I could read Hungarian books and look at maps of Hungary. I can't. When I see people, when I go to Melbourne and I see tourists with cameras and taking pictures and walking around, I think, I could never do that. Go to a strange city and just look at the buildings. I couldn't imagine anything more boring than staring at the outsides of buildings and taking pictures of them. But maybe I'm being a bit unfair to tourists. I hope I'm not. I don't care if I sound eccentric. That's just who I am. And one man said to me once, oh, when you retire and you've got a bit of money, that's when you'll travel, isn't it? Well, I'm retired and I'm not short of money. No way am I ever going to travel.
Well, and it sounds like, again, you do so much traveling, I think, with your mind's eye, that you explore the world in a different kind of way. You don't need to be there physically to really appreciate it. And certainly your life force comes through. The fact that you have turned your hand to poetry in your late 70s is just a wonderful testimony to how interested you are in life and the work ethic that you have. And I'll just follow up on that because I know you've written over a dozen books. And when you were younger, you worked as a teacher. You've raised three children. You have a strong work ethic and a sense of incredible inner discipline. Would you talk about how you go about writing a book in terms of your day-to-day schedule or just sort of, a day in the life of Gerald Murnane at this stage in your late 70s?
Well, the years of my marriage and my parenting were quite often chaotic. Any parent of three children would know what I'm talking about. I couldn't plan a daily routine very often. And I learnt the trick of just writing when time was available. I never, ever watched television or I used to listen to radio at times when I was young. Even nowadays in this little township, people who don't know much about writing or reading, and they say, oh, where did you get the time to write your books? I say, by not watching television. If you add up the hours that people spend in front of television, that's an enormous amount of time. Well, that's one answer. The other trick, I'm not a great admirer of D.H. Lawrence, but I read once in a biography of his, a biography about him, he could write in a crowded room and listen. He would half listen to conversations and even take part in them, but meanwhile he'd be writing. I used to write. I had no room to myself when the kids were growing up. They all got a room to themselves, and I write at the kitchen bench. And my wife would be doing the dishes, and two kids would be arguing with their teenage friends in the next room, listening to music, and I was at the kitchen bench with all these sounds going on and writing my latest book. One thing I didn't ever have to do was write for money. I was always a part-time writer, so if I had 3 months, one of my sons might have been sick for 3 months, as he was once in 1977, I could stop writing. There was no need to write. And when the time was available, then I'd use it again. And the other thing, my books were never planned as whole books. I could quite often plan them as chapters or sections, small sections, and I could write one self-contained section over a period of 2 or 3 days and then didn't have to be I didn't have to have a great deal in the mind while I wrote, just focusing on that little section that I was trying to complete. And the last thing that bears on this is that I only ever wrote when I felt compelled to write. I can't imagine what it would be like to say, now what will be the subject of my next book? I waited sometimes between books for a year or 18 months, and then suddenly I'd have this burning urge to write about something that affected me deeply. And I mean, the urge was enough to keep me going, to find my way through whatever difficulties were in my way at the time.
Well, thank you for those reflections on writing. I just have a couple of other questions I'd like to ask. At this stage of your life, do you have any heroes or role models?
Yes, my better self. I have a theory. Theories about a lot of things, haven't I? I have a theory about which I borrowed from an American, a wonderful American man called Wayne C. Booth. He died in the last few years. He was a teacher of a professor at the University of Chicago. He wrote a book called The Rhetoric of Fiction, in which he went some of the way. I mean, I have this complicated view of reading and writing. His was just as complicated, a bit different from mine. But he had these layers of writers that, when you're reading a book, you're just reading the words of a person that whose name's on the cover of the book, and behind that person there's another writer. The person that I have as my role model is the strange, almost unknown part of myself that first feels the urge to write and then carries it through and forces the lazy part of myself, the daily distracted part of myself to write. I'll try to put that in a slightly more clear form. The person that you, if you were sitting face to face to me, I'm just the ordinary everyday Gerald Munane. I don't think much about books or I just think about the daily needs and practical needs of life. But left alone at my desk or in some solitary place, another Gerald Munane emerges, and he's the deep repository of all my deepest longings and instincts and those images that I mentioned before. And he's the one, and he's not a bad bloke. He's not a bad guy. Through all the difficulties, I've had a lot of troubles. My wife was ill for many years, and I had to run the family on my own with very little help. Things like that. This other guy, this deep Gerald Munane, somehow kept going and managed to achieve what he's achieved. And it must sound to some people a crazy thing to say, but he's my role model. I want to be the best part of myself. I want to be the equal of the best, the possibilities, that the possible Gerald Munane. That's a good name for him. Possible Gerald. I want to be possible Gerald.
Well, and I love that idea of looking at what you see as kind of that better part of yourself and holding that up as what you're striving for. Now I'm going to ask you if there's anything you're trying to change about yourself.
Now, I've written down something here. I made a note. Yes, all my life, I've felt obliged to other people. I think it's not a bad characteristic. I don't know where I got it from. I was the eldest child. Maybe that helps to explain it. But I've always found it hard to say no to people. I was rather ill last year from the effects of radiation. A cancer that I had, and I was asked by a good friend of mine to come to Melbourne and launch a book for her, and I should never have gone because it turned out to be a very difficult and painful time for me, but I went. And that kind of over willingness to oblige people is something that it's a good thing to have in some ways, but in another way, I intend to be, in whatever years remain to me, aloof and to say, sorry, look, I've got important things of my own to do. I can't help you. Sorry, got troubles of my own. And to end on a lighter note, for many years I didn't have time to play the fiddle, but I've got a violin which I call my fiddle, and last year or so, when I wasn't terribly well, I took it out and started playing it again, and it worked wonders for me. And every day nowadays, faithfully, I practice it for an hour, play the sort of music that affects me, and the thing that I want to change is I want to be a better fiddler.
Well, that sounds like a great goal. And I appreciate you being honest about, as you're saying, the need to also kind of be a little bit more focused on yourself and what you need, especially at this season in your life. Final question. I'm just wondering, as you think into the future, how would you like to be remembered?
Well, they can remember me however they wish, but I've arranged, everything's planned. I've got all the instructions for my sons. I'll be privately cremated. Ashes put with my wife's and my eldest son's when he goes up in the Garoque Cemetery. However, they can arrange a funeral, a memorial service, and people can talk about me. And I hope that one of my sons says, whatever he achieved in life, whatever he did with his books or whatever, we never knew him to neglect us for one moment because of any other task that he had in mind, books or reading, or his students, or whatever, that he put us first. And I, as I said, had a happy, long, happy marriage, but there were very many difficult years in it. And during those years, I put my sons and my wife first. And my hope will be realised that no one will say of me that I ever neglected them for one moment for some preoccupation or ambition of my own.
Well, that's a beautiful thought to end on. Thank you for sharing that. It's been a great pleasure talking with you, Gerald Murnane, about your thoughts and your life experiences. To the audience, I want to thank you for tuning in to Your True North. You can listen to our podcasts at yourtruenorthpodcast.com. Please join us again. Thank you.
You've been listening to Your True North with Cindy Camp. The opinions expressed on today's episode are not necessarily those of WXAV 88.3 FM, St. Xavier University, or the producers of Your True North. For a copy of today's program, you can download it as a podcast by visiting yourtruenorthpodcasts.com. Thank you very much for listening to Your True North.